Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I muse about the recent cancellation of the Look Ahead Research Project in the United States. I chat with Lonnie McMichael about some upcoming work she's engaged in, and I spotlight a piece from the Fat Heth Lump about the time that we waste in our lives. In the United States, the research project Look Ahead, which has been federally funded for the last 11 years, has recently been canceled 2 years early due to scientists not finding the results they were expecting. The Look Ahead project took over 5,000 overweight and obese Americans with type 2 diabetes and split them into two groups, a control group who would continue living their lives as normal, and an experiment group who would be subjected to interventions in the way of lifestyle changes, so restricting their diets and getting them involved in regular exercise. The study was specifically interested in looking for two things. One was weight loss, permanent and meaningful weight loss, and the other was looking at the difference in heart attacks and strokes between the two groups. The study concluded early because the researchers, after following these people for 11 years, found that there was no difference whatsoever between the two groups in relation to cardiovascular disease and stroke. The group in the experiment group, who had been going through these lifestyle changes for 11 years, had no better health outcomes on these two measures than the group in the control group who had not made any significant changes to their lifestyle. Of course, the researchers are excited to say that the group in the experiment group maintained a 5% weight loss after 11 years. And of course, they are calling this a successful weight loss treatment. To put that into perspective, an individual who weighed 160 pounds at the start of the treatment, 11 years later, weighed 152 pounds. And this is being proclaimed as significant weight loss, meaningful results, and a way to show that anyone, just anyone, can lose weight and keep it off if they just try hard enough. Leslie Kinzel and Paul Campus have already added their thoughts to the results of this study, and I'm sure that many more will be coming out. In fact, I myself will probably write a blog piece about this in the near to future. But what's interesting the most to me to see will be to see how this is largely taken by the larger public health community. So this results in this study aren't actually new. We've known that permanent, meaningful weight loss cannot be achieved for 95% of the people who try to do it. We've known that since the 50s, maybe even earlier. What'll be interesting to see is what kind of spin this gets, right? Will this become another, even 5% of weight loss can produce health results, even if that actually wasn't shown? Will this be simply yet another reinforcement for the idea that the only way to quote-unquote solve the obesity problem is through weight loss surgery? Or will this allow lobbying to get the FDA to further restrict and release the restrictions on weight loss drugs that like to be trialed? Because we all know that the real problem here is obesity, and anything that we need to do to fix this problem is going to have to be done. Today is Dr. Lonnie McMichael, an instructor of professional and technical writing. She researches the medical rhetoric on fat, and her book, Talking Fat, was published by Pearl Song in July of this year. Lonnie, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Maryland.
Always glad to do it.
I'm excited that you're here because you've got a new book coming out soon.
I do. It should probably be coming out mid-year next year.
Okay.
And it's from Pearl Song Press. It's called Acceptable Prejudice, Fat and Social Justice in the United States.
And what does this new book look at?
I actually use bell hooks, ideology of domination. Bell hooks is a feminist black woman writer who really looks at how domination works in our society. Mm. And I use her idea of how domination works, her basic concept, to look at how fat works in the United States.
Oh, that's very cool. I love bell hooks. Her and Audre Lorde both were huge, huge part of my master's degree experience. So I think it's very cool that you're taking her work, which has been almost exclusively used in one specific context in terms of looking at issues of race and ethnicity and those kinds of domination, and actually looking at it in terms of oppression of a different group of people, that being of fat people. That's very cool.
Well, one of the major points that Hooks makes is that if we don't nip all domination in the bud, if we don't get to the root of all domination, that that all dominations will continue to perpetuate. And,
right.
and it's easy to make that argument with fat, because fat's actually hiding a lot of the dominations that we say are not okay.
Right. Well, it's the idea of oppression being intersectional. So it's not just simply that we're fat. It's that we're fat women, or we're fat women of color, or we're fat disabled women of color, or we're fat queer disabled women of color, and those kinds of things. So we, like you were talking about, in terms of it's not just kind of one. It's these different layers and the way that they intersect.
Yes, definitely.
So what? So that acceptable prejudice is based on work that you completed as part of your PhD. What is it that you're working on now?
I'm working on a project called The Unlovable Child, Collateral Damage in the War on Obesity.
Oh, that's such a sad title, The Unlovable Child.
And there's a lot of, I've had a lot of people very uncomfortable with that, and I really debated about it, and it could potentially change. But I come back to that idea, first off, of shock value. I want to hit people hard. The things we're doing to our kids today are just unacceptable. Simply unacceptable. And what it does is it leaves fat kids feeling like they're unlovable, unwanted, unworthy, and this is not acceptable practice.
Right.
And so I want to hit people hard, and a lot of people, have a lot of issue with the title because they feel like that's telling fat kids that they're unlovable. And really what I'm trying to do is get people to realize that they are telling fat people, fat children, that they're unlovable.
I guess when I think about that, because I've actually seen a couple of different threads of people talking about the title, and one of the things that kind of occurred to me is that that I guess, like, if I had to think about my own childhood, and this is by no means in terms of my parents, because I was really blessed to have amazing parents, but not so much that I would have classified myself as unlovable, but maybe as unloved.
Well, and definitely, and that has been suggested that I change it to The Unloved Child, or also to Feeling Like an Unlovable Child, and I may. But the shock value is pretty strong, because
right.
when people see that title, they immediately say, no child's unlovable.
Yeah.
Which is true. You know, fat children are not unlovable. So I'm still debating on that one, and I may actually bow to pressure and change it. It is that's one of those choices. It is a rhetorical choice, and it's a hard one to make. But I think people need to think about that fact that what we're telling these kids is they are unlovable.
So, what got you interested in kind of pursuing this idea of like fat children and the effects that our quote unquote war on obesity has on them?
Well, one of the things I believe is that sharing our experience is a very, very powerful, both healing for the person who shares it and healing for the person who hears it. I don't have children, and I'm not especially great at working with children. but I wanted to do something for the fat children and everything they're experiencing today. Because we know, those of us who were fat kids, we know what's going to happen. You know, these kids who've been put on diets from very young age. We know how that messes with our relationships with food and our body. Those of us who experienced being teased and bullied by teachers and adults, let alone the other students, we know how that affects self-esteem and that kind of thing because we lived it.
Right.
And so what I'm wanting to do is pull out people's experience, hopefully helping them heal in the process of talking about that experience, and then turn around and be able to show people the consequences of what they're doing with adults, people who lived it. And then also give those adults who felt like that unlovable child ideas of how to heal. So, you know, I'm talking, trying to get people to talk too about how have they moved beyond this, how have they healed from it. So it kind of has two purposes. One is to be a cautionary tale to adults who are working with children. And the second one is to be a healing guide for those who were a fat child and experienced those things.
So are you looking for people who are willing to talk to you about their experiences of being fat children?
Yes, that is what I'm looking for right at the moment. I'm actually in the research phase. So I'm looking for people with a very broad range of experiences. I would love to have some people with intersectionality issues, you know, someone who may have been disabled and how fat affected that, or if they're of a you know, not the non-white race, where, you know, everything, we tend to get everything white around the
right.
white individuals. And I'd love to have some people of color involved. And then also, you know, people who may have had a very standard experience, because that sometimes can really give us a viewpoint of exactly how fat prejudice itself works. And so I'm looking for people to just talk about what happened as a fat child. You know, were you put on a diet? And if so, how did that affect you? Or did you choose to diet? And what made you decide to choose to diet? And how did that, what were the long-term consequences of that? Relationship, you know, talking about our relationship with our body and a relationship with exercise and with food, any of that kind of thing, I'd really just love to have people's stories. The more experiences we have, the more people we can help.
So the people who might be interested in participating in this with you, are you just interviewing them? Is it a phone interview, a face interview? Is it over email? How will you be collecting people's stories?
I actually have a list of questions. The question that I will send through email. The questions are not hardcore. I don't need people to stick specifically to those questions. They're just to get the conversation going. If someone wants to write me their story in whatever way they would like to, I will accept any submissions. I can't promise everyone will be in the book, but like I said, the more experiences we have. Basically, people talking about what kind of interventions were done on them. And I don't want to limit it specifically to fat children, because I know there were children who were not really fat, but were put on diets and that type of thing, and it created very dysfunctional relationships with food, and out of the fear of being fat.
Right.
And so all of those experiences are valid and could help us look at what's happening to the kids today with this focus on the obesity epidemic.
And in the book itself, will you be using, like, people as case studies, or is it more kind of thematic and then using people's, the information they give you as illustrations of the themes? Do you know how you'll be analyzing it that way?
Yes, I usually do the thematic. I look at a particular area, so, you know, our relationships with food, and I'll talk about this person found this and this person found that. I'll talk about the problem, and then I'll go into, and then, you know, as adults, these individuals have found solutions this way. You know, this person found this solution, and this person found that solution. And also, I'll, you know, look a little bit when doing it by theme, that way I can look a little bit into the science around it as well, the research that's being done, both research that's problematic and research that may be supportive of finding a true solution to these problems.
And if there are people out there who are interested in participating and telling you their stories, how can they start the process?
If they would write me at lonnie.mcmichael@gmail.com, and my first name is spelled lonnie.mcmichael@gmail, I will send back a consent form, and they have to agree to the items of the consent, and then I will send the questions.
Okay. And how long do you expect the research part of the project to go on, the data collection?
Well, I was looking at an end date of November 30th. I may push that off till December 30th, but I am wanting to get everything together by the end of the year. That way I can get in and get the real writing done next year so we can get the book out by 2014 at the latest.
And how many participants are you hoping to get? Do you have a number in mind?
Well, I'd like to have at least 30. There's no top limit. You know, the more we have, the more experiences we have, the more people we can touch. So there's no top. I am hoping to have about 30. I've probably had about 22 who have responded so far.
Are you experiencing any kind of saturation thus far in the 20-some-odd people that you've already gotten data from?
No, I am not seeing any kind of saturation at this point. Experiences, I mean, we have some basic experiences that come up, but those become reinforcing. You know, if we have 10 out of the 30 people who respond, you know, saying, I was put on a diet and this created an incredibly unhealthy relationship with food. But even then, the subtleties are different.
Right.
You know, individuality, I love speaking from people's experience. I do a lot of research in the science, and I do a lot of research in people's experience. And what I find is people's experience tends to hit other individuals harder because it makes it real. It makes
right.
it human. Science has a way of dehumanizing us and making us just a number.
Right, in terms of like empirical, quantitative stuff.
Yeah. Right. And so when we get into the qualitative research, we tend to get a little bit more of an individual feel to it, and you can it's easier to connect with a person than a number.
Right. Well, Lonnie, thank you so much for coming on today and chatting about this. Hopefully there will be people listening who will contact you or contact me to find out how to contact you. That'll want to participate in this with you and want to share with you their experiences as fat children.
Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Well, you are welcome back anytime.
Appreciate it, Kat.
Spotlight today is a piece from the Fat Heffalump entitled How Much of Our Lives Do We Waste? This was published on August 23rd, 2012. Quote, it happens almost every day. Sitting at the communal lunch table, usually playing pocket frogs or reading a book while I eat my lunch, I hear it start. Oh, market day is my downfall. I turn into such a piggy wig. I don't eat dairy, gluten, or sugar. You know they're poison and make you fat. Well, I did go for a run yesterday, so I guess I can have bread today. Ooh, that looks so yummy, but if I eat anything like that, I just get so fat. How many calories are in that? How many carbs are in that? You're so naughty. Good on you. I could go on and on and on with the kind of anxiety in analyzing food and eating that I hear every day from people, mostly women, all around me at mealtimes. Women often use angst about food to bond with each other, and you cannot get away from almost constant analysis and judgment of food and what other people are eating. And don't get me started on the amount of judgment over what fat people are eating. Yeesh. I've heard so many stories of fatties having complete strangers stop them in the supermarket to berate them over the contents of their shopping trolleys or being commented on in public for eating anything. You can't eat a salad because that garners comments on how you must be doing it to lose weight. And you can't eat an ice cream because then you're a gluttonous pig. It's a no-win situation for fatties and food. I have so many of my own experiences being shamed about food and eating by both complete strangers and people in my life. We could be here for a week. What I wonder, though, is how much of our time and energy are we as women wasting on thinking about food? Because it seems the more people put judgment on food and eating, the more time they spend thinking about food. In my experience, the women who make the most judgmental statements, like I have listed above, are the ones who constantly talk about food. And I've noticed my own behavior change as I've removed all that angst and judgment about food from my own life. Back in my dieting days, food was all I thought about. Because I couldn't have it, and because it had so many rules and regulations and conditions, I would obsess over the food I wasn't eating all the time. I have made all of those statements listed above at some time, and many more. I would spend hours justifying every morsel I ever ate, every rice cracker, every celery stick, every raw almond. Conversations over meals were all about how I had earned the food or how I was naughty for eating something. Basically, I not only wasted a lot of time, but I was a crashing bore as well. I mean, really, isn't there something more interesting to talk about over a meal? Or if we're going to talk about food, how about we talk about it without all the moralizing? About its flavor, its texture, where it was sourced from, how it was prepared. Or perhaps we could talk about how some people have access to higher quality food than others, usually based on wealth. Anything has to be better than putting false morality on food and eating. Personally, I have embraced the hashtag free fatty philosophy. I refuse to be judged for my food and eating choices, and refuse to participate in the moralizing of food and eating. Plus, I refuse to justify what I eat. I don't need to provide a reason for eating either a salad or ice cream. It's my body and my life. If other people think I shouldn't eat something, they can mind their own damn business. While I'm still having to work on undoing a lifetime of baggage around food and eating, I am finding the more I let go of that judgment around food and eating, both for myself and for others, the less obsessive and anxious I am about food and eating. Part of the oppression of fat people lies in the constant demand for us to justify our food choices. We have to constantly prove we are being good because we're fat. We're not allowed to ever eat anything that is perceived as bad. People watch every morsel that we eat, and they do. I can't tell you the number of times someone has tried to out me for eating something that is bad or unhealthy and place judgment on us for whatever it is. Ask yourself, how often have you heard someone describe a slim woman eating ice cream, say, as sexy? Yet in the next breath, referred to a fat woman eating the exact same thing as gross. How often do you see comments from fat haters that say, just put down the cheeseburger? Firstly, what other people eat is no business of anyone but themselves. It comes under the, if it's not your body, it's not your business rule. So we don't need to justify our food choices. Secondly, I'm sure we all have things we'd much rather be doing than obsessing over food. What can we do with our time and energy if we don't waste it on angst and analysis of every morsel that we put in our mouths? End quote. Thanks for listening to another episode of Friend of Marilyn. Friend of Marilyn is brought to you by Access Manawatu 999 AM. If you'd like to contact the show with questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for topics or guests, please email us, friendofmarilyn@aol.com. You can also find Friend of Marilyn on Twitter and Tumblr. Closing the show is Mary Chapin Carpenter with The Hard Way.